Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming at a busy time of year. And it gives me very great pleasure on behalf of the LSE and the Development Studies Institute, and most especially the LSE Africa Forum, to welcome Claire Short to us to speak to us tonight. Claire is a friend of the LSE and a friend of Destin, having spoken to students in the Institute for a couple of years running. Always been very generous with her time, and is always pleased and excited to share her ideas with us. I'm sure you're all very well aware that Claire Short was Secretary of State for International Development from 1997 till 2003, when she resigned over the Iraq War, after a very difficult decision-making process and some brave statements and decisions. Her account of this, for those of you who haven't read it, is in her book recently published, An Honorable Deception, New Labour, Iraq, and the Misuse of Power. I'd highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't read it. Tonight she's going to talk to us about Africa, a priority for the UK. She is talking to us on this topic with the upcoming G8 meeting in July in mind. And without any further ado, and with Africa very much in all our minds at the moment, I hand over to you, Claire Short. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here. I was invited by the Africa Forum to speak about the UK government policy towards Africa in 2005, and I assumed that was in the context of all the spin and razzmatazz about the G8. And it's a complicated thing to talk about, but I think we should talk about it, because the whole thing makes me extremely queasy, but you can seem as though you're just sort of being cynical, but I think we ought to try and analyse what's going on, what's likely to come out of it, what it means. So you know, all of you, there's been enormous razzmatazz in the lead up to this G8 meeting in Gleneagles. And Tony Blair, a prime minister massively damaged over Iraq, lost the trust of the British people, and flailing about for a legacy that he will feel proud about, has promised to sort of fix Africa and global warming at the meeting of the G8 in 2005, which I think is extraordinary. I'm surprised in a way that there wasn't just a kind of great outburst of laughter, simply because these monumental issues of big continent with a complex history and series of issues to be attended to, and global warming, God help us, are enormous issues. And, you know, the G8 meets once a year and takes it in turns among its membership about who will chair it. And Britain's been the chair before. It comes round every 8 years, unsurprisingly. It's not a delivery mechanism. The last time we were chair was the G8 meeting in Birmingham, I think in 1998. And the first one Tony Blair went to was in Denver just after the 1997 election. And in Birmingham, because there'd been a very big agenda in Denver and not much had come out of it, they decided to have a very short agenda. And if you remember, the debt relief campaign was going very strong at the time. And all these debt relief campaigners were coming to Birmingham, and all the churches and cathedrals were opening up. And they had no intention of discussing development. But because the people were on the streets, debt was put on the agenda. They spent some time discussing it and came out with an initiative on debt 1 year later in the Cologne meeting that improved the way in which debt relief was delivered, in my view. But now, that seems to me the right way around, that you have a meeting of the G8 and they've got their plans and the people come out on the streets and make them do something different. Here we've got the convener of the G8 inviting the people to come on the streets in order to press them to do something historic and fine, which is a peculiar way of organising events. And of course, the G8 with Britain in the chair coincided with Britain's presidency of the European Union for just 6 months, which also comes round, rotates, as you know, it was an issue in the Constitution, around all the membership. And so it coincided, these two things were happening in 2005. And I think, and I'm one of the least cynical people I've ever met, but I think a damaged Tony Blair post-Iraq going into the election, playing up the significance of being president of the EU and chairing the G8 and promising to do historic and fine things was significantly about positioning and image improvement. And I think we should face that and be clear about what's going on. Otherwise, everyone's going off in a bubble and, you know, we can't be hard-headed about what might be achieved and what might not be achieved. Now, I personally am made very queasy by all of this. The treatment of Africa as a problem to be solved at one meeting of the G8. The setting up of the Commission on Africa significantly, what, in 2004 in order to report in March 2005. But I think the days when a European politician is going to set up a commission to decide what the problem is with Africa and what needs to be done are long gone. I think that's insulting and improper. But then they announced, and at the suggestion of a pop star. Well, he used to be a pop star. I don't remember, actually. I mean, he's probably my kind of age group, but I don't remember his band being particularly famous, but he's certainly famous for his engagement in Africa. I mean, after they announced it, they then invited a number of African presidents and senior African figures to be represented on it. And I thought, well, fair enough, they'll write down the best of what we know and maybe that will mobilise people to get on with implementing it. But there's still something not right about doing things in that way round. But it could be turned to good use. Now, there's no doubt, as we all know, and I'm sure would agree, that the levels and depths of poverty in Africa are very troubling and a very serious issue for the people of the continent and for the world and Europe in particular, the near neighbours of Africa. It's the poorest continent, the poverty is deeper and broader and it's getting poorer and it's facing very significant population growth, very destructive probable consequences of global warming and the continuing consequences of the HIV/AIDS disaster, both the suffering and the loss of life to which that leads, but the economic consequences of large numbers of people of working age losing their lives and leaving elders and children behind. And there's no doubt, of course, that Europe and the West's engagement in Africa inflicted enormous harm on the continent, from slavery to colonial exploitation to the ridiculous post-colonial boundaries that damage the prospects of the of independent countries in Africa that didn't have natural, geographical, or ethnically based or language group based country boundaries. And then, of course, and I think this is too little discussed, the way in which both sides lined up in post-independence Africa, manipulating the continent and all its tensions around the Cold War tensions, continued to inflict enormous harm and meant that the continent wasn't truly independent and was still being manipulated by outside interventions and enormous armaments being brought into the continent. So there's no doubt that Africa, there's lots of serious issues and desperate human need, and it should be attended to, and the West has deep guilt engagement in it. It's probably the levels of poverty in the world are the biggest moral issue the world faces, and in terms of just hard-headed European self-interest, if Africa continues to be in this kind of difficulty, it's damaging to the self-interest of Europe. So there's no doubt that the situation in Africa should be attended to and we should all do better. But one of the things that worries me about this present razzmatazz is that Africa is being used as an object of charity, of pity, in a way that somehow belittles the continent, its people, the complexity of its own history, the struggles of people in the continent against oppression, and the struggles that are taking place on the continent now for people to move their continent forward. A European politician heads a commission as though no one else knew what was supposed to be done. Buy an armband and send an email to your MP and you're a good guy, and there's something wrong with it, right? It's the whole complexity of a whole continent being treated. I mean, we didn't talk about the Balkans in, you know, when we had war and ethnic cleansing. We didn't organise a pop concert and get ourselves some armbands. You know, that wasn't an appropriate response to a kind of political and economic and military crisis. So there's something in the very tone and style of it that there's something wrong with it that encapsulates a wrong attitude towards Africa, I think. Difficult to talk about this because it all sounds as though you're against generosity of spirit, and obviously lots of the children who are putting on the armbands are just saying, I want the world to be more fair, this isn't right, and that's, we welcome that generosity of spirit, and one doesn't want to be negative about that, but the leadership of that is a bit more cynical, I think, and we ought to call it for what it is. So what I would like to try and do in the rest of the time available to me, and then we can open to discussion and see what you all think, is try and be a bit hard-headed about the current campaign, where it's coming from and where it leads us. Now, the first thing I want to say is that you may remember in October 2001, Tony Blair, just re-elected for the second time, came to give his speech at the Labour Party conference, and it included these words about Africa being a scar on the conscience of the world. You'll all remember. I nearly fell off my seat. We'd been in power for a whole term, and he hadn't taken a blind bit of interest in Africa. And I used to joke very openly in my department how good it was that Alistair Campbell wasn't interested, because we were able to be much more radical than we otherwise would have been if they'd been bossing us around like they did other departments across Whitehall. So I don't know where it came from, I thought. But never mind, I thought. We can get him behind the best of what we're trying to do, and the development stuff we need to push on with, and there's not much he can probably contribute there except increase the budget and so on. But in terms of conflict resolution, we need more action in the UN and so on. We could really drive on in getting the peace process in the Congo implemented, peace in Sudan. This was before the Darfur crisis had broken out and so on. So I used to say to him, Angola, DRC, Sudan, three countries that had moved forward recently and come to peace, three massive countries with potential that if they all move forward would really lift up the economic development of the continent, focus in there. Which he didn't much. I thought afterwards, and I say this in the book, where did it come from? Because similarly, Clinton, who had just ceased to be president, did virtually nothing about Africa when he was president. And then he started visiting Africa just right at the end of his presidency and then making lots of speeches about Africa. Which, better late than never, but it's a bit irritating when he used to be the most powerful man in the world and then he didn't notice. And then when he wasn't, he suddenly thought it was a very important issue. And I thought that that's what happened to Blair, that Clinton spoke to him. But I'm afraid since then, I've realised that Tony first went to see Bush when Bush was elected, before our election. And we now know from all the books that they discussed a number of things, including Iraq. And I think it was deliberate positioning. He knew he was going to go with America on Iraq, and he wanted to play up Africa as a kind of triangulation. You might not like this, but I know you like this, so I'll keep you all in line. Now, that's horrible, but I think that's what happened. I now think the dates say it, and it's the way in which he proceeds. So I think that's where it came from originally. And then I've already said, so he made that speech in 2001... Not a lot happened, but the wire discussion, if you remember, the G8 in Genoa, and there were demonstrations, and a young man died, if you remember. Kananaskis, the African presidents were invited to those meetings. NEPAD had reported, President Mbeki and others came to those meetings to talk about NEPAD, Africa, how things could go forward. The G8 set up a commission of special representatives on Africa. So that's what happened as a consequence of the 2001 commitment. And then, as I've said, but I don't think much on the ground moved forward. But then, as I've said, we were pre-election. The UK had the presidency of the EU and the chair of the G8 coming up. And suddenly, It was Tony Blair and Gordon Brown talking about how significant this might be before the next election and how we could do a lot for Africa. I've already said that it's a bit of an extraordinary thing to suggest that one G8 meeting can fix it. And of course, I think lots of people think, gosh, these are powerful representatives of the rich countries. But I must tell you, in preparing for G8 meetings, and I've been involved, I was involved in quite a few, and they have Sherpas, you know, preparing for a summit, and they have pre-meetings. They're not meetings that produce a lot of change. They often have one-off initiatives. I remember there was one on TB in Russia. So you have, you know, the Sherpas, and they meet, and everyone says, because there's a very virulent forms of TB in Russian jails, multi-drug resistant, that really need some attention. And people put a bit of money on the table, and often it all fizzles out. I mean, it is not famous as a... Of course, those members in different parts of the international system have got great power, but the G8 tends to have one-off initiatives that often don't go very far. I mean, that's its record. And, of course, when you're president of the EU, you've got to keep everybody together. It's not a position of great power. You know, it's like chairing a meeting. You talk less than when you go to the meeting and you're free to talk because you're not chairing it. So there's a great exaggeration in the potential power of that. And then in all this talk about doubling aid, and I absolutely believe that aid should be properly spent, it should be seen not as a gift or charity, but seen as an investment fund for helping countries put in place the institutional arrangements that will enable them to deliver development and improve lives to their people. But the UK aid record, if you just put the razzmatazz to one side, is that in 1997, we inherited from the previous government a budget of £2.2 billion, or 0.26% of GDP. And after two terms of Labour government, we've got, and it was a struggle, I can tell you, to, by 05-06 financial year, £4.6 billion, or 0.4% of GDP. And after a major campaign, the promise in the last comprehensive spending review was that by 07-08, and the general election will be in 09, the next one, it will have got to £6.5 billion, or 0.47% of GDP. Now, the claim of global leadership and doubling aid and everybody getting to 0.7 is over here, but the real record of real spending in the real world is the one I've just given to you. It's an improvement, and I think there's been an improvement in the quality of the way in which British aid is deployed and British influence in the international system. But British UK public spending is more than £500 billion. So these are very tiny amounts of money for all the OECD countries. Reaching 0.7 of GDP in its aid budget is peanuts compared with their expenditure on public services in their own countries. It's not an unaffordable amount. You could lose it in the small change of what you're spending on health and education and so on. So that's another thing about the razzmatazz. If you're going to claim leadership, then shouldn't we be at 0.7 already? Whereas talking about doubling aid and having a very complex, this international finance facility where we're supposed to, this is Gordon Brown's big idea, borrow against future aid flows on the international markets in order to bring the money forward for spending now. And the implication is that there won't be as much needed after 2015. It's very odd. Because, of course, there's going to be... world population is going to carry on growing very significantly. We're going to have, by 2020, 2030, 9 billion people in the world. Most of the new people will be born in developing countries. So even if we do well on the Millennium Development Goals and halving the proportion of people living in poverty, there's still going to be a billion people. So why, and that's because you can spend now, pay later, it seems to me. It's not a very desirable objective. I've told you about the G8 in Birmingham, and I think partly what's here is the UK government wanting to create something like the G8 in Birmingham, because it was a real genuine movement of civil society. It did move people. Something big was going on. It did reach across the world. But this time they wanted to induce it in order to promote Britain as a kind of big heroic figure on the development stage. There's one other thing I want to say, which also sounds mean-spirited, but also makes me uncomfortable. I don't like it when British-led NGOs speak as though they speak for the poor of the world, when we have wonderful international communications, and people living in the African continent and indeed people from that continent are living in our own country. There's something out of balance there too, that this is a game of charity, and that young, well-meaning people who work for an NGO can get up and speak and say what the poor of the world need and want, and we don't have to bother to ask them or allow them to speak for themselves. There's something wrong and unbalanced, and that's, it's still in the charity box, it's in the pity box, it's not in the justice box, the entitlement, the right for people to live in a just world order and to have all their human rights fulfilled. And then, as you know, Bob Geldof, having lived off the fact that, yes, in the farming conditions in Ethiopia more than 20 years ago, a lot of pop stars got together and had a concert that moved people and raised, I think it was £20 million or something of that order, have lived off that reputation as a sort of spokesperson for Africa in a way that's really very peculiar. The current spending on humanitarian disasters in Africa is about $1 billion a year. So it was a nice concert, it was a good thing, but good heavens, what is this? 20 years ago, one concert. It was well-meaning and so on, but it's out of proportion, the claim to leadership and solution. And I've even heard people say, well, we went to the concert, we collected the money, and they've still got poverty, what's the matter with them? I mean, that's the other danger with all of this. But so he said there wouldn't be another concert, but now we're having a concert, not to collect money for perhaps the terrible situation in Darfur, because the background to all of this getting ever worse. So we're having a concert, we're pretending we're saving Africa, but on the ground, in the real world, 2 million, 3 million people are being displaced by violence and threat, and they're not able to farm and they're going hungry, and we're not attending to it sufficiently, so things are getting worse. What kind of a kind of world are we living in when everyone's marching for Africa and in the real world that's going on and we're not doing enough about it? But this concert isn't to collect money for the people of Darfur or to draw attention to the failure to act to stop the violence that's being inflicted on them and their suffering. It's to raise political awareness. And they just decided that they didn't need to invite many African musicians. There's something wrong with that. I mean, Bob Geldof has said it's because you've got to communicate with the European and North American audiences, and they wouldn't turn out for some of these great African musicians that are now so famous across the world. But it seems to me that's not right either. So here we are. All of this is going on. The basic demands are more aid, debt relief, which, by the way, counts as aid. So, you know, those figures I give you, if debt relief is given, it counts as aid. It's not additional. It's just a different way of giving aid. There are myths about debt relief, as though it's the answer to everything, and, you know, it's magic, and it wipes out all problems, and it's just not as simple as that, as I'm sure you all know. More aid, debt relief, and then better trading conditions. Now, there's no doubt the trade rules are deeply skewed and unfair, and the dumping of subsidised agricultural goods on international markets undermines farmers in developing countries, and particularly African farmers, in relation to their potential exports into the European market. And there's no doubt, if you look at Africa's exports, the coffee comes out green, it's roasted and processed in Europe, and then sold on, and most of the added value goes to workers and people in Europe. That's true of the cashew, it's true of the cocoa, even the fair trade chocolate bar. The only thing that's fair trade is the beans out of Ghana, the chocolate's made in Europe because of tariff escalations. And if you process, the tariffs go up. And this is disgraceful and unbalanced and needs to be corrected. But of course, what we're saying is fairer trade rules with very few specifics. And we need specifics because we need fairer trade rules for developing countries, but what the bigger, important alliance that's come together since Cancun of South Africa, Brazil, China, India, and so on, who can't be ignored in a trade round, and quite rightly are making demands for fairer trade rules, the poorest countries have different needs. If you just opened the markets for them, they wouldn't necessarily be able to take up all the benefits, and a lot of them have got distorted trading arrangements because of colonial history and because of quotas. So we need something very much more generous for the poorest countries. And I don't see anywhere the specific demands for that. So it's going to be general. We should have fairer trade rules, and that will be dealt with at the Hong Kong meeting of the World Trade organisation. So there we are. There's the concert. There's, I think, the reasons for it. There's the meeting. What do I say? Lots of good people, good young people think, yes, I support this. I'm going to go on the march. The world should be more just. Africa should have a fairer chance. And all that motive is completely sincere and decent. But I think it's being manipulated in the ways that I've described. What are we going to do? And you know, in the meantime, Darfur gets worse. The Congo peace process isn't driven forward. There's been much less progress in Nigeria than everyone hoped after it moved to independence, and similarly with Angola since the end of the war. What are we going to do about it? I think there's a danger for the leadership of it that if very little is delivered, public opinion will turn nasty and be angry with them. But there's also a very grave danger that there'll be spin that great things were promised, and then life won't get that much better in Africa, and people will say, huh, we had the Live Aid concert, we had Glen Eagles and all the marches, and all these promises of more aid, and Africa's still poor, so what's wrong with Africa? It must be their own fault. So what should we do? I think we have to be hard-headed in watching. We have to look at the numbers. When they say aid's going to increase, we have to say how much, which year. I mean, increase is promised by 2015. It's 10 years away. And lots of the needs are now, when we have to look at the specifics on the debt promises and the rest of it. So I end with this. Africa is being misused for positioning purposes, I have no doubt, by politicians and some pop stars. Lots of very genuine and sincere people who want to see a more just world and understand some of the historic injustice that's been inflicted on Africa are supporting this campaign because they believe it's going to produce something good. Therefore, we shouldn't just sneer, but we should make our analyses. That's my view. But we should look very hard at the outcomes in terms of numbers and reality and when they're going to be delivered, and not accept generalised spin about what's being produced. And if there's little, then the criticism should come out very clearly. And the other thing I absolutely think is we should say to them, and we should say this much more loudly, don't keep telling us that you care about Africa and doing nothing about Darfur. There's 2 million, 3 million people who've been displaced. And there's a humanitarian disaster. And lots of them are in Chad in camps, which is desert-type conditions with very little water, enormously difficult conditions. And even the humanitarian effort isn't adequate. The African Union is bravely taking the lead in trying to resolve the situation. What we need is a UN resolution mandating the African Union-led force with powers not just to monitor, but to intervene to stop violence, having a much bigger force. And of course, if you get a UN mandate, it's paid for, so you can have African Union leadership, but with the funding, and then NATO and the rest can help with helicopters and logistics. And then we'd really have some kind of operation, and that is doable. So that's my final point, really, that we have to turn this round and say, if you're sincere, what's the numbers? What's the timescale? When are you going to deliver it? What precisely did each country promise, including the UK? And can we have some immediate and urgent action on Darfur? The other thing I would say, and I'll finish with this, I think the BBC programmes of action that are brought about by this focus on Africa, I haven't heard all of them, but I've heard some of them on the radio. I tend to be a radio person, and I have heard some authentic African voices speaking with enormous dignity, books being read, voices coming out of the continent. So something that's less cynical is coming out of the focus. And I think you're beginning to get real, genuine voices of Africa and that enormous dignity that lies in the continent and amongst its people beginning to be heard. And what we must do is turn the manipulation into something more decent and build on the genuineness of heart of some of the supporters, scrutinise the delivery from the and separate it from the political rhetoric, and open up more spaces for those authentic African voices to speak for them for themselves, and to talk to us about a genuine partnership to support Africa getting more justice in trade, in ending conflict, and aid that is properly used to help countries rebuild and create the conditions for their people to have a better future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Claire. I now am going to open the floor for discussion and questions. And we have quite a lot of time for that, so can we take the first one at the back there?
Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I would actually have like to challenge you on the direct connection to Iraq and thereafter ask a question relating to that. If we had to look over the last 40-odd years, since the end of colonization, starting off perhaps with Ghana in April 1957, it does appear that virtually every one of the now 52 different sovereign states in Africa have posed separate and different questions for British prime ministers, not directly related to Iraq. It might have been Rwanda, it might have been Blair's decision to deploy HMS Ocean Battle Group to Sierra Leone, and so forth, or even the current SAS operations in West Sahara against Islamic terrorist bases. So Iraq does appear to be just one small issue of many putting Africa on the agenda of the Prime Minister every single week. This sort of poses a question, actually, in terms of 52 sovereign states. There's a generalization in this G8, and indeed a generalization through your speech, talking about Africa as one entity. What could we actually do with the colonial history that we have separately for 52 different sovereign states, each with their own infrastructure and different problems? What sort of priority, what country would you think, suggest, that Britain should concentrate on first to look for success?
Let me respond to that, and then there's usually... Yes, but we didn't have a concert after Rwanda or a promise of some... In fact, Britain's record on Rwanda is as bad as everybody else's. It was very little reported here until the big movement of refugee movement out of into Goma, out of Rwanda and into Goma. But Britain's representative in the Security Council refused to strengthen the UN mandate, refused to use the word genocide and so on. So, I mean, just the reality, it's before the Labour government came to power, but the reality of Britain's record on Rwanda is as disgraceful as the disgraceful general record of the international system. So Rwanda happened, but Britain didn't do anything. In the case of Sierra Leone, because it's interesting, British troops were deployed in order to evacuate Brits and Europeans. And the decision to leave some there was because of the embarrassment of potentially taking out the Whiteys and then leaving Sierra Leone to another collapse. And then, so it was a turn that had to be struggled for. And then, you know, there was a UN mission and it was fairly messy. And the fact that we had some British troops over the horizon actually helped to give some credibility to the UN. And then British troops helped the Sierra Leoneans train up their own army and it became a useful engagement. But it's talked of in Britain as though Britain went to war in Sierra Leone, and we didn't. So, but yes, Africa is a continent right next to Europe that's been very damaged by Europe's engagement and has lots of poverty, weak states, crises, collapse. In the immediate post-Cold War world, when both sides withdrew their interest and aid went right down, so you could see how cynically it had been spent beforehand, there were often very oversupplied armed forces in weak state institutions, and we got an outbreak of violence and conflict. So I agree with you that Africa's there, whether you're interested or not, but we didn't have great sort of promotion of Britain as a solution to all of Africa's problems in that era. Of course, issues will arise. But what can be done by a country like Britain if we were doing it genuinely and intelligently? I think that's your real question. Understanding some of the history and the faults and the blame. My own view is, to try and put it briefly, the overwhelming priority is the end of conflicts and then the helping countries build the institutions of modern states and getting regional trade integration to overcome the stupid colonial boundaries and the way in which they distort the economic arrangements of Africa and the prospects of inward investment and processing and so on. Processing for agricultural products for the European market ought to be in a globalizing world, one of Africa's great possibilities. The other is call centers. What are we doing having call centers in Asia when there's Africa with enormous language skills right in the same sort of time zone as Europe? But because of the instability and conflict and so on, we're not getting that kind of investment, which is the explanation of the very rapid economic development in East Asia. So much bigger focus on working with the African Union now, much strengthened, to bring these conflicts to an end, to drive forward peace processes, to the new use of development assistance to help countries openly in partnership build up the strength of their institutions so they get effective modern states, and then that regional economic integration and the encouragement of economic growth and inward investment. I mean, that's the kind of analysis I think you need for Africa. And I think if we shared it, and it's shared by lots of people in the continent, we could have a real drive forward. And then we could get, you know, some very rapid economic growth, which is needed in order to reduce poverty, and much better public services. And I think Britain, I mean, there's some of that in the Africa Commission report, because of course it writes down, you know, some of the best thing, but it's an enormously long report. I don't know if anyone's, I keep hearing people say it's good. I've actually read it. It's very hard to read right through. But it says what NEPAD says, and it says what the best development thinking was, but it's so broad, and then it says have lots and lots and lots more aid, that it's not like an analysis that says, okay, these are our duties, let's get on with it. It's a generalised saying of everything in the world that ought to be done, which means it won't change the debate very significantly.
I have two short questions. The first one is, do you not think that there are vested interests in the international political economy as well to keep Africa deprived? Because you described that there are egoistic interests in Europe that we should develop Africa, but then I wonder why there hadn't been more incentives to actually do that. And the second question is if you think that regional integration in Africa would give a stronger voice to fight for fair trade.
I think that the vested interest, the exploitation and the misuse explains the economic condition of Africa. I don't think it is now in the interests of Europe to keep Africa in that condition. I think the risks of the instability and indeed the inability to trade and invest and so on is no longer in the interests of Europe. I mean, that's my answer to your first question. But I do think the exploitation and misuse explains a lot of the current condition. Outside Europe, you mean like America? The thing that's coming very big is America's interest in the oil of West Africa. And the oil, I'm told by oil people that Nigeria's oil is sweet, as they call it. And I think we're going to see much more American engagement in West Africa for oil reasons that's going to have all sorts of consequences to the continent. So that's a change, you know, as they get worried about declining oil in the Middle East, etc., and there are signs of that coming. And then, of course, the other thing is, with the situation in the Middle East, it flows into Africa. There's anger and feeling amongst the Muslim communities of Africa about the situation in the Middle East. That's understatedly there, too, as a further potential disruption. Of course, the politics of North Africa is tied up in the politics of the Middle East and the disastrous handling of that. Your question's a very important one. Is the current misuse of Africa in the vested interest of the rich countries, or is it no longer in their interest, but is the consequence of their previous selfish interests? Because if I'm right, there's some hope about us getting together and getting on with it. If I'm wrong, then the misuse will continue, presumably. Will regional integration strengthen Africa? I personally feel very hopeful about the African Union. The whole constitution of it, the ideas behind it, the energy that's been displayed in it compared with the OAU is impressive and interesting. So I think that Africa coming together, and obviously you've got to build new institutions and nothing's ever perfect, but there's a new energy and leadership there that is important potentially for the continent. And the fact that the African Union has tried to take the lead on Darfur is really important, and that's why I'd like to see it backed up so much. So that's Africa solving its problems with proper backing from the international community and having a success in dealing with a very serious problem, rather than being left in the lap of what might go on in the Security Council without it being consulted. So I think that's enormously important. And on trade issues and so on, there's much more African countries speaking to each other, talking about what they want out of trade rounds, you know, starting to act together. I mean, certainly, if we're just going back to Iraq, when the African countries that were on the Security Council, when Tony Blair and co. was desperately trying to get his second resolution, there were French going to see the African representatives to try and get them to vote with the French, Brits going to see the African representatives, what was it, Angola, Cameroon, Guinea. And then Thabo Mbeki, you know, which you can get very cross with Thabo about HIV AIDS and Zimbabwe and so on, or I can, but on that, the African Union went round those countries and said, you're part of the African Union. We've had a vote on this. We said no. Now that's a new Africa. That kind of thing, it wasn't going on before. It's only the beginnings, but it's something very important. And then I think within that, regional economic integration will obviate the colonial boundaries and some of the destructive divisions that they bring about in terms of economic development, very small markets, lack of prospect, therefore, of greater economic development, inward investment, and so on. So those, I think those things are hopeful. We need to get behind them, and they need to steam forward.
I just wanted to ask a question about governance, because this is something which has been in the press recently and highlighted as a real issue and a reason for some of the cynicism that we keep hearing about, that the aid won't actually reach the people on the ground and it'll go into the pockets of corrupt politicians.
This gentleman. Yeah, I'm going to take a few and then answer them.
Thank you. My question is partly answered by what you've just said. My main point is about what Africa is already doing for itself. Because what you just said, of course, is true about the manipulation of Africa. However, the presumption is, because if you make it on a premise of being manipulated, you also paint a picture of a manipulable, vulnerable people, the same image you're trying to kind of avoid portraying. Some of us, as you just suggested, some of us are not fooled about by the charity kind of gesture and approach. And as you just said, many African leaders, quite a number of African leaders, are not fooled by whether the G8 meets or doesn't meet. They're already doing something about their situation. In terms of integration, as you just said, in terms of addressing security issues, and even before then, even currently, as you rightly know, some countries even during the Cold War or just towards the end of the Cold War didn't depend on the West to liberate their own countries. I could give you an example of which you are maybe familiar with, Uganda, where I come from. Uganda had bad governments from Idi Amin to Obote. As you know, President Museveni, who led a rebellion in the 80s, liberated that country from all those dictatorial regimes. And with the support, of course, he has not done it in isolation, with the support from Western partners and others, he has transformed the country for over the last 17 years. Though I'm aware you have your own problems with him, but at least, of course, he has done part of it with the Western support. However, what I'm trying to say is people have been able to liberate their own countries, not necessarily depending on the West. So Africans are not fooled and look to the West and think it's going to solve all their problems. So Africa can solve its own problems, however, not in isolation. So what I'm trying to say briefly is,
We've got your message, brother.
Yeah, no, you got my message.
I've got quite a few hands, so if you can...
Okay, what I'm trying to say as well is we should not also presume that these are homogeneous, just as Africa cannot be homogenized. There's not a homogeneous concern for Africa. Different countries have geopolitical reasons. As you know, just on the BBC the other day, the same government.
I'm going to have to ask you to pass on to the next speaker, please. There's a questioner behind. Thank you for your contribution.
You just mentioned something about ending the conflict in Africa, and I don't know how you can do that. Well, the UK is one of the most producers of weapons and exporters to Africa. And even, for example, in 1990, up to 1997, Zimbabwe, which you hear a lot nowadays in the media, was one of the main recipients of UK weapons. And I say this, another important point is to bear in mind that the UK is one of the most influential countries in the IMF, International Monetary Fund. In fact, as you know, Gordon Brown sits on the Financial Committee.
He's the chair.
Okay, he's the chair. And as you also know, that in IMF, IMF has an influence in every aspect of those countries, their policies, apart from one thing, and that is the army expenditure and the amount they spend on buying arms. So I don't really know how you can kind of reconcile these two, talking about ending the conflict. Well, for example, UK is one of the countries that corrupts Africa in that way, as I just mentioned.
I'm going to take two more from up here and then give you a chance to respond. So over here.
A bit of a shorter question. I'm wondering if, just hypothetically, if Gordon Brown next year offered to give you carte blanche and increase the DFID budget, would you go back and be part of the government? And if not, why not, knowing what you know about Iraq?
Okay, and then the gentleman up in the corner, and then I'll come back to you too next round. Yes, and if you can keep the question brief.
Yeah, just two short questions. One, given that it's now accepted that free trade is not fair trade, what do you think should be done to make the WTO enforce that free trade objective? The second question is specific. What's your view on the recent UK government's withdrawal of aid from specifically Uganda due to lack of, well, alleged misgovernance and handling of coming elections? And do you think that should be the right way forward to ensure that democracy leads to development and lack of conflict?
The first question was, there's a lot of cynicism about quality of governance, and therefore people say aid won't reach the ground. In fact, of course, in the Cold War years, the use of aid was deeply, deeply cynical. So massive aid to Mobutu, the most obvious example. Everyone knew he was a dictatorial kleptocrat, but he was a pro-Western dictatorial kleptocrat, and he was aided significantly up to, I think, 93, 94, something like that. And aid was used very deliberately and manipulatively for Cold War reasons. After that, the aid levels to Africa cut enormously. I mean, that in itself says something cynical, you know, at the end of the Cold War. But then there was a sort of, because of problems of poor governance, weak public expenditure systems, bad procurement, corruption in the public finances, aid tended to be spent on projects funded outside the government machine. And you got the famous example in Tanzania of 1,000 major aid projects, 2,000 aid missions a year, aid agencies recruiting people out of the civil service, and the state institutions crumbling more and more as aid projects were funded. Some of them might be quite good, but once the aid stopped, they were going to collapse. So nothing was being built up in the country. And this shift to, on the back of the ideas on debt relief that came out of the Birmingham and Cologne summit, that countries should put in place their own plans for reducing poverty through growing the economy and having better public services for all their people, discuss them openly, and then ask for aid in partnership to help drive the reforms that we deliver. So, for example, instead of funding lots of schools, you work with the Ministry of Education in Tanzania, put some money into the budget, but on condition then that we clean up the finance management system, so the country also means its own tax money then is going to be better spent and not as corrupted. So that was that big shift, and I really believe in that shift. But I can remember President Mkapa saying to me, and he was very keen on all these reforms, he was a very significant reforming president, just coming to the end of his presidency. But he said, I've got corrupt magistrates all over my country. You gave me the separation of powers. What am I supposed to do? So you can start to clean up public finance management systems or even taxation systems when you've had a crumbling state with, therefore, weak institutions, civil servants not paid a living wage, therefore everyone has to be on the fiddle. You know, we would all be if we were in those circumstances. And I absolutely believe in this model where you come together as equals with an open, transparent plan for how the country's going to reform itself that's openly discussed in that country, so it's owned by the people of the country. And then you work together on institution building and help countries build strong modern institutions of a state that can deliver then education to all its children and so on. So that's the new model, and I think that's much more respectful and much more useful. And it's aid as an investment in enabling a country to get all its things moving so then it can do it for itself. It's a transition. So that's my answer to that, and we have to... I mean, when I took over at the Department for International Development, we'd just been elected on the promise to have a stronger development department and reverse the decline in Britain's aid spending, did some public polling in Britain, asked people if they believe in aid. They say no, corruption, useless. Asked them if they believe in investing money in every child in the world getting a chance to go to school and have basic healthcare, and they said yes. So it wasn't compassion fatigue, it was a disbelief in the old models of aid, and I think that's very important. I think we need to discuss that more and have more people being clear about it. The question on what Africa's doing for itself and the case of Uganda, President Museveni, and of course with support from Tanzania. I don't know if you remember, but in the case of Kosovo, military action without a UN mandate but to prevent a humanitarian disaster, which a lot of people in the international system thought was justified because there would have been a Russian veto, the precedent was Tanzania into Uganda as the precedent in international law where it was legitimate to have supported Uganda. I mean, anyway, it's interesting. It's another example. But the truth is, and everybody knows it, when apartheid was still there and when Mozambique and Angola had to fight for their independence against fascist Portugal, because we still had a fascist government in Portugal at that time, because the Cold War was on, only the Russians would back them, then the West engaged and involved and created civil war in Mozambique and Angola, and the apartheid regime got involved. So you've got Africans fighting for their own freedom and independence, but the machinations of the Cold War smashing up the honesty of that fight, making it much more difficult, generating a civil war that inflicted enormous harm. And if you look at Eritrea and its fight for independence, the way first the Americans, then the Russians get involved in providing arms to Ethiopia, making that far more prolonged. So, yes, of course Africans have always done something for themselves, but there have been all these interventions holding it back, making it more difficult, you know, monstrously distorting it. And there's a chance now, with apartheid gone and the Cold War over, of a much stronger African leadership. And the building of the African Union, I think, is an example of that. And there are models of success in development. Tanzania is doing extremely well. Ghana is doing well. Rwanda has rebuilt itself and is going forward remarkably, given what it's been through. I think Ethiopia is starting to move personally. I mean, there are some examples of success in development, significant economic growth. And if in the regions of some of those successful countries there was more peace, I think you'd get models of success that people in neighbouring countries would say, we want reforms like this, and we'd get on a virtuous circle led by Africa's own advance. I mean, I think that's where we are. Of course, nothing's homogenous. But we talk about Europe as well, by the way. I mean, Of course, Africa is an enormous continent, and yes, we know surveys show some people think it's one country, but we do also talk about Europe. I mean, it isn't, there's nothing wrong with talking about a continent as long as you understand what a big thing a continent is, and the range of different peoples and experience and levels of economic development there will be. How can we end conflict when there are UK exports of arms? You're absolutely right. For example, after the consequence of Rwanda and the war in Congo with six different African countries involved in it, Uganda, Rwanda, Zimbabwe, Angola, and so on, Zimbabwe wanted to buy hawks. And we had a real argument inside the government. And number 10, as ever, overruled us and said we should still sell the hawks to Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe. And of course, they were being used to bring in weapons and things. And Zimbabwe was making some very funny contracts with Congo, you know, taking over forests and so on. So that cynicism is there, and you're right. But we have to challenge it. I mean, a country isn't, you know, a series of cynical decisions. There are other decisions. And of course, in lots of the conflicts in Africa, it's small arms. It isn't all imported. There's the capacity to produce bullets and ammunition within the continent. So we need much stronger tightening up on arms exports. I agree with you. But the fact that a country like this has a record of lots of arms sales, yes, is something disgraceful and to be criticised and to be controlled. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't, people of goodwill shouldn't say we ought to unite to support a continent with new leadership in bringing some of its conflicts to an end so it can have economic development. And indeed, I see one of the things that they're proposing for the G8 is an international treaty controlling arms sales, which is a good thing, but it'll take a long time to be a solution, so you can be in favour of the good and not do it immediately. And then you raised the question of the IMF. Britain's not one of the most important influences in the IMF, but it's a significant player there, I agree with you, and Gordon Brown chairs the committee. Of course, African governments are represented in the IMF too. One of the things that frustrates me most about the IMF is that actually the voting power of the European powers is greater than America if they'd only stand together. So on some of the issues where the US feels it owns those institutions and can control them, Europe could, you know, challenge for a different kind of policy outlook if it would stand together, but tends not to do so. And I'd also say when we had right-wing governments across the world, the IMF was used to drive neoliberal policies. When you get change in governments through elections, you get change of policy in the IMF. I just ask people, it's a public institution and we should control it, not just write it off, because we can change the way that it behaves. But on arms expenditure, you're right. In my time, we were having a big battle on this. As we move to the new paradigm on development, and then it's countries sorting out their own taxation system, their own financial management system, and therefore there's transparency about how much is being spent on health and education and so on, I was arguing it should be the same with defence. Clean up the procurements, let's be transparent about how much is spent, different countries have different needs, it shouldn't be a secret matter. And we started to have cooperation with some countries on security sector reform, including one with Uganda, which is highly aided, as you know. And that created tension with President Museveni. He likes to keep his defence procurement rather secret. And that's where some of the problems are, I'm afraid. And it creates a real problem, because Uganda's achievements in progress on universal primary education, on moving forward now on health and free healthcare, on containing the HIV/AIDS epidemic has got some very important examples of success and lessons of success for the rest of the continent. But the problem of Museveni wanting to stay on and breach the spirit of the constitution that gave a time limit is a very serious problem. And what I think that the UK and other countries should be doing is standing alongside voices from within Uganda that are challenging that, which is what happened in Malawi. President Malusi tried to do the same thing. There were voices in Malawi that spoke up against it, and then development agencies and so on said, this is very important, this is your constitution, this is the voices of your country, you've got to listen to them, and kind of reinforced local voices rather than trying to control it from themselves. If Gordon Brown, whoever it was, someone up there, asked me to go back, which I don't think for a minute he will. One, I think he's going to be made the offer to take over so late that everything will be falling apart and he won't be Prime Minister for long. But secondly, if he asked me to go back and said you could have all the aid and lead on development, I mean, this isn't the most important question, but without a change of policy on the Middle East, I could not do so. I think the Middle East is a disaster and is going to go on being a disaster. And I don't think there's going to be a settlement on Israel, Palestine, and that flows across the world, because of course if you keep ignoring international law, then the UN is ever weaker, and then our capacity to act together, to deal with conflict, to get environmental agreements is weakened. So, but I don't think I'm going to have that negotiation. Free trade isn't the same as fair trade. I mean, the truth is, free trade was a Western slogan, but we didn't have it. Free trade is meant to be just a level playing field, but what was Western countries were doing was subsidising their agriculture, dumping below cost. That isn't the principles of free trade. So, one, we never had free trade. But secondly, I'm one of those who think the formation of the WTO, which only came at the end of the Uruguay round, so it's only been around, whatever it is now, 6 or 7 years, as a membership-based organisation and a rules-based organisation, the countries join by choice. Now the majority of its members are developing countries. This is a completely different thing than the old trade rounds under the GATT when regions negotiated. And what we saw in Cancun with the coming together of the, what did they call it, G23? Whatever the number was, because the numbers are who joined. But that was the big block of the big, powerful, middle-income developing countries, South Africa, Brazil, China, India, and so on, saying, just a minute, we're not having this anymore. We've got some demands to make out of this trade round, and you're not going to reach agreement unless we're satisfied. But you could get that and still have the poorest countries not having a voice. You've got then the coming together of the African, Caribbean, Pacific countries and the least developed countries, saying, and we need to be satisfied too. Now, to get a trade round, we need those two groups to stand together, and we need the powerful middle-income countries to realise that the poorest countries need some extra offers. We might get it, but we've got more chance of getting it now. We've got a membership-based organisation where the developing countries can group themselves than we ever had out of the old system. So the WTO isn't perfect, but it's a lot better than the old GATT, because that was just regions that negotiated. I've answered your other question about withdrawal of aid, yeah.
Okay, I think another round. I'm going to ask a few people down here and then come back up there, and then if there's time, come back over this side. This gentleman here.
You just spoke very passionately about your vision for African ownership and sort of African leaders and African people doing their own thing, and I think that's absolutely wonderful. Can I ask you what your perspective is on what's happening in Ethiopia right now, considering that you were very supportive of Ethiopia and you applied precisely your vision to putting a lot of aid into Ethiopia and supporting Prime Minister Meles, who seems to be in a bit of a bind now with the sort of disputed elections.
Thank you. A gentleman here, and then a gentleman here.
To be specific about Nigeria, and you've mentioned Nigeria being a bit disappointing in its recent performance, given your knowledge of the country and recent heightened American interest in Nigerian oil and the next round of elections in 2 years, what's your sense of how Nigeria is doing and what it needs to do to get it right this time?
And actually, while the mic's there, this lady here.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask, get your reaction on South African newspapers last week ran a story, in fact, Thabo Mbeki's comments or reaction to Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown is said to have stated that the days when Britain had to apologize for colonialism are over. And in addition to that, he said Britain should be proud of its empire. Now, for a country that is taking leadership on Africa in 2005, that's a problematic statement. And I'd just like to get your reaction to that.
Thank you. This gentleman here.
It's more of a comment, really. If we're talking about a dutiful, humanitarian, moral impetus in European countries to, as you say, reshape African institutions, at heart, what I think we're talking about is what colonial policy thought it could do. This is still the white man's burden. And I'd like to ask, have you, in your time in government, ever come across African initiatives which have been rejected out of hand because of that attitude?
Yes. My question is on your emphasis. You mentioned several times the genocide currently occurring in Darfur and the lack of emphasis placed on it. Yet, given the effectiveness of the history of effectiveness of aid, why are you placing the emphasis on increasing aid to African countries, which is not the emphasis of most African governments, and why not on intervention, whether military or military support for OAU troops in Darfur, which could be much more effective in saving human life and creating stability in the region?
Okay, three questions up there, and then I'm going to close this round.
I share your concern about the leadership of the Make Poverty History campaign and the fact that they're too close to your Labour government. But I can't see the benefit of a lot of your negativity that's come out in the press over the past weeks. It seems to me that for once this is a campaign that is not about charity, but is about justice and raising awareness of the real issues of Africa in this country. And shouldn't you be trying to help strengthen that movement from inside by working with the NGOs that are doing really good work there, the radical NGOs like War on One, like the World Development Movement, that do bring African voices to the people of this country, rather than criticizing it and frankly sneering at it from outside? Or are you just bitter because you're not getting the attention you used to, and that in your 6 years of government, unfortunately, you didn't achieve a lot of the things that they're now asking for?
Thanks, Claire. I'd just like to say thanks very much for coming here. As an African myself, I can tell you that you never can talk enough on the continent. Bob Geldofs, I share your cynicism with him about his effectiveness of action creating change, but I always think that you need to talk about it, keep putting it out in the public's eyes, and that kind of thing. What I really want to hear your views about is about Africa's initiatives, particularly NEPAD, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the only complete initiative they've had in just about ever. Particularly the letter of it, of the P on the partnership side, where they no longer wanted just free handouts. They wanted to create real partnerships where they could build in tandem with Europe and the rest of the world. Really just wanted to hear what you think about that.
And in the front row.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to problematize your sort of discussion about intervening in Darfur. In two ways, very quickly. First one being the fact that if there were to be an intervention, a British one, I assume the Americans would join in, and the fact of seeing American and British troops led by Tony Blair and George Bush sent into a country ruled by Muslims with oil, it's a very problematic idea around the world. And let's not forget, of course, among the many various reasons given for the Iraq War, one of them was a humanitarian intervention. And that would be the exact same thing for Darfur. And number two, the question arises, why Darfur? Why not focus on other parts of Africa? And most specifically, of course, the 3 million people who've died in eastern Congo, but other conflicts, including northern Uganda, even southern Sudan, other parts of Sudan. And most problematically, actually, is one of the conflicts that nobody ever talks about, and that's the one of Western Sahara, on which there's been many UN resolutions over decades calling for a referendum in the area, and nothing has been done. And that wouldn't require any kind of military intervention. It would just require Morocco to enforce UN resolutions.
Is that the first one, Ethiopia?
Yes.
I'm less well informed in detail than I used to be. Were you the one who asked about Ethiopia? My reading on the Ethiopian elections was that there was a diminution in the support for the governing party, but they still probably won in a broadly reasonably fair. That's I thought that's what the outside observers had said, or that the reports I've read said that. I know they're being rerun in part of the country that isn't complete. If that's so, I think that's probably good for Ethiopia. I mean, to have a challenge but carry on with the existing government. I think there is a real effort going on to drive some reform and advance. The levels of poverty in Ethiopia are stunningly serious, and the growth of population has been very, very big, so the prospects of getting the kind of economic development that can enable people to lift themselves out of poverty is a very serious challenge. It's the second most populous country in Africa, the very proud and fine history of, and still a deep sense of pride as a nation, but desperate problems of poverty. So I'm feeling it's complicated. The war with Eritrea was a tragedy and a waste for both countries, but hopeful that progress is taking place in Ethiopia, and hope that that there can be more room for free elections but still economic progress. I think there's a real problem about the West's democratic model. In a very, very poor country with people of disparate traditions and origins, there's a danger with just our kind of electoral model that you can get breakup and weaken the capacity to make decisions. So obviously you need some kind of accountability and elections, but if we just push our model onto countries that with much more difficult challenges, I think it could get in the way of successful development. Nigeria, was that you? I'm impressed by the current finance minister in Nigeria and the team around her and their efforts to drive serious reform in the management of the public finances and all that tough stuff. And there's definitely a mood in the country that you will know more than me that really wants to challenge corruption and the misuse of public resources. So something's going on that's really quite important. What a pity that wasn't there from straight after when democracy came in. And that's got to be built on, and the voices that are coming out of Nigeria that demand that kind of change. I think what's a pity is that it took so long and that there wasn't more, because obviously Nigeria is one in four of all Africans, black Africans. I mean, it's a massively important country for the continent. And of course, because of oil and all the rest of it, the levels of corruption are very deep and getting reform is very difficult. But I think stick with the reformers now and really drive it and try and make sure that the voices of the people of Nigeria who are demanding change are really listened to. But if only this had all happened as soon as President Obasanjo took power, Nigeria would be a lot further forward. Yes, my understanding of Gordon Brown when he visited Africa is that he gave, but I read about this in other papers, that he gave an interview to the Mail, the Daily Mail, and he'd been reflecting on Britishness, and he said that there was nothing to apologise about Britain's colonial history and Britain should be proud of empire. I think that's shameful and disgraceful, and I think Thabo Mbeki was absolutely right to criticise him and attack him for it. And it weakens his claim to be an alternative to some of the problems we've got in the Labour leadership. There was this guy here saying if Europe has a duty to behave morally and support development in Africa, it's the same incentive as colonialism. I disagree with that 100%. Colonialism was pure extractive exploitation and oppression in order to get minerals and wealth out of the continent. There was no moral imperative behind colonialism, and don't be fooled by any such claim. So, and you know, if Europe is concerned about war and conflict and suffering in the Balkans, you don't say that's colonial. So I don't agree in any way that a proper concern for a just and safe work and sustainable world and the kind of interventions that would get behind the reform movements in Africa to help them to be successful and move forward is motivated in any way by the same intentions as colonialism. But you then asked whether I was aware of any initiatives that had come out of Africa that had been rejected because of bad motivation out of Europe. I think that was your question. The whole Francophone, Anglophone, who's controlling what game still goes on in Africa to a disgraceful degree. So when you get in Rwanda, Congo, Burundi, the reforms that are needed there to bring to an end all the misgovernment and suffering of the Great Lakes region, you get horrendous games between France, and then maybe Belgium will support it, and Britain, in the World Bank, in the UN and so on, which is just old colonial hangover games that are outrageous, and they hold back progress and stop just single-minded attention to the kind of progress that's needed. That's still out there, I'm afraid. That's the example that sprang to mind when you asked your question. Then there were two questions on Darfur. The first one said, why don't we attend to Darfur militarily and we don't need to increase aid? Actually, there are a lot of starving people because they've been displaced from their lands by violence, and therefore immediate humanitarian assistance is needed to keep people alive. I mean, when you get that kind of violent crisis, you also get a need for it. This isn't long-term helping countries build their institutions. This is just keeping people alive while you try to attend to the underlying conflict. So I think for you to pose, either you attend to Darfur or you call for an increase in well-spent aid to help countries who've sorted out their conflicts to build their institutions, they're not opposites and alternatives. They should all go on. And you said it's not the view of African governments that they want increases in aid. That is untrue, I have to tell you. And I think President Mbeki has been visiting the US and others to try and get support for the claims for the G8 meeting to get a doubling of aid to Africa, and that's the African representatives on the Africa Commission. That was very much one of their demands and one of the demands of NEPAD. And then you had an assumption, and it's in the other question, that intervention in Darfur means UK or US or NATO or whatever military moving into Darfur to save lives. That is not what is needed. Just as NATO took the lead in the Balkans, but then had a UN mandate giving it the power and funding for the NATO-led UN operation that came rather late in the case of the Balkans, and it should have moved much earlier, you need African Union-led UN authorized and funded with help with logistics. So they don't need or want, and I agree with the second question, it would be disastrous, isn't invited and isn't being proffered either, US, UK kind of troops on the ground, but a mandate for a bigger force with greater powers. They're only there as monitors, with powers to intervene to stop the use of violence and rape and people being displaced, funded through the funding that comes automatically with a UN mandate. And then what's going on? NATO is talking to the African Union monitoring force about what logistics it needs in order to be able to move around a very big territory. So that's what's needed. So no one's asking for or offering or proposing UK troops or US troops or anyone else, but backup for the African Union so it can really do the job that needs doing is what's being called for and what I think we ought to do. And then the next guy is just completely rude, so I think I'll just leave you. I agree with his neighbour who said the opportunity to talk about Africa is what we must capture out of this. There is cynicism in what's taken place. Not so much in the NGO campaigns, but NGOs have to spin like governments spin. But it puts the issue of what's wrong in Africa on the map. And then what we need to do is get into an honest debate and an informed public opinion amongst all those people of goodwill and not allow the spin to take it away and then it end up generating cynicism. And that's partly the purpose of coming here today to talk about what's going on and what we might do about it. You asked about NEPAD. I think the six big powerful countries, not all of whom were reformers by any manner of means, who came together and drew up NEPAD without much discussion with people in Africa, that was, you know, Egypt, Algeria, Nigeria, and so on, South Africa. That was criticized in the continent that lots of people in Africa had not been consulted about it. And some of the demands are for large amounts of aid for infrastructure projects and so on. and so it was criticised as being a shopping list for big projects. And I think some of that criticism is valid, the legitimacy of the group who drew it up and the nature of it. But I think all of that is outweighed by African governments coming together themselves and taking a lead in saying, what do we need to do in our continent? And calling very much for reform in governance, dealing with corruption, cleaning up public sector financial management. I think that's very important. It's another very healthy development alongside the building of the AU. Voices coming out of Africa, making their own reform agenda and diagnosing some of the problems around corruption and weak governance and the problems that's been for the continent. So I think overall it was very beneficial. And if you read the Commission for Africa report, it's a sort of stitching together of some of the better DFID and other development organisations thinking with the NEPAD report. I mean, it's very much in there, and that's what the African representatives on the Commission brought into the Commission report. And I think the trouble with any word, partnership is a good word. It really means a meeting of respectful equals, understanding that they've got a mutual interest. And I think the best of the new model of development is that. But that's why some of the elements of the campaigning around the G8 are going away from that, and that makes me a bit queasy. But I think things are moving on the ground in Africa, and the African leadership is there. And with the Cold War over, that's going to be much more powerful and uninterrupted with. And I think that's where all the optimism lies, and there is optimism. Was that the last question? Oh, no, problematic on Darfur. Well, I've answered you. There was talk about... was that you? There was talk about the US and the UK at the beginning. It all, I understand, was... what's his name? General Mike Jackson was asked at some conference whether Britain had any spare capacity after Iraq, and he said we could mobilise 600. And it was taken to mean that Britain was thinking of going into Sudan. It never was. Britain was never offering, it wouldn't be welcome, the African Union wouldn't want it. It isn't proposed and it isn't the way to deal with the problem. It is to bolster and strengthen the African Union intervention. And then you gave a list, why Darfur? There are 3 million of people are displaced, people are dying, people are hungry, it's going to get worse. So just in pure humanity and reality, we've got a crisis here, and then you have to act or we're going to see lots and lots of people dying in front of our eyes on television cameras again. But that doesn't mean you do Darfur and not Eastern Congo. I mean, what we've got in the Congo is a peace process brokered and led by South Africa in a very good and strong way, some of the sort of consequences of apartheid ending and Africa joining its continent, and a weak UN operation. And it just needs more attention and driving forward and stopping those militias in Eastern Congo being armed and killing people and misuse of the rich minerals of that part. So we should be, I mean, so the Congo peace process is an African initiative, but it needs more backup and strengthening in order to make faster progress, and we should be doing that as well. And indeed taking an interest in Uganda and northern Uganda, which I think is very mysterious why there isn't faster progress there. Now they don't have bases in Sudan. And the cynics think President Museveni might need a conflict in order to procure a lot of arms, but I'm sure that's not true, but I've heard people say it. And then, yeah, Western Sahara, I'm limited in my knowledge of that. I agree, it's an issue that's been put on the back burner where a great injustice has been done. There was some big American political leader, Baker, was it, who was leading on it for the UN, and I think he's resigned, and people are not getting justice in Western Sahara.
I think this is a good moment to say thank you to Claire Short for a really, really interesting talk, and to say especially thank you not only for sharing her ideas and insights, but for her frankness and her challenge and her passion. So thank you, Claire.